still mad, until the boxes were flattened enough to squeeze through the hole. Afterwards, they tried to square him back up, but he never did look quite the same. As soon as they'd carried off the boxes the boys had piled up to climb on, they started off after the trick-or-treat group. Fortunately, Ken knew the line of march, and since they didn't stop at any houses, it wasn't too long until they caught up. They even had time to collect a few more treats before it was time to go home. But it would have taken more than a few pieces of cheap candy to console April and Melanie. After they got the two smaller kids uncostumed and sent home, they sat on April's bed and stared at each other gloomily. "What are we going to do?" April said finally. "We just can't play the Egypt game with those boys there." "I don't see how we can either," Melanie said. "But what else can we do? You know what will happen if we try to keep them out. We can try to play it anyway. Then, if they're just too awful, I guess we'll have to give the whole thing up." It was a terrible thought. For a few minutes, the two girls contemplated the possibility in mournful silence. At last, in a more cheerful voice, Melanie said, "Well, at least we don't have to give up yet, thanks to Elizabeth. If she hadn't had that idea, I'll bet those jerks would have finked on us right away, just for the fun of it." "Yeah," April said wonderingly. "How about that, Elizabeth? How'd a little kid like that know how to handle those two creeps? I'm pretty good at handling adults and people like that, but boys, yick." Melanie grinned. "You know, it's sort of like what you do in nonviolence. My mom says it's appealing to their better natures." "Better natures, phooey," April said, wrinkling up her nose. Moods and Maybes. The next day at recess, Toby Alvilar sidled up to Melanie and April. Before he started talking, he looked around quickly to be sure no one who mattered was looking. Ken and Toby didn't believe in talking to girls. Of course, it was all right to make comments at girls, particularly if they were insults. But real conversations were out, at least in public places. "When are you guys going you-know-where again?" he asked, sort of out of the corner of his mouth. "I don't know," Melanie answered. "We're not supposed to go there at all yet. They're still not letting us play outside because of the murder and everything. But my folks are weakening, I think. Caroline says I can start playing outside again as soon as Melanie can," April said. "Well, look, Ken and I won't go there until Friday," Toby said. "Try to get your folks to spring you by then, okay?" April and Melanie exchanged surprised glances. "Oh, we're not just being Boy Scouty," Toby said. "My dad got mad at me and restricted me for 3 days, so I couldn't go before anyway." April and Melanie tried not to giggle. "Yeah," Toby said. "It's all you guys' fault, too. My dad got mad at the way you guys mashed up my costume. Parents." Toby rolled up his eyes in an exasperated expression. "All I ask him for is an idea for a Halloween costume. At first he says he's too busy to think about it. He's an artist, and he can't even think up a little old costume idea. Then, all of a sudden, he gets this brainstorm, and he spends a whole day making the costume, plus a couple of hours putting me into it, and then he's so hung up on the whole thing that he gets mad when I squash it a little." April and Melanie broke down and giggled, and sure enough, Toby was encouraged. "Yeah," he said. I just walk in the door, see? And my dad gives me this cold look and says, How many were killed? I start saying, What's he talking about? And he says in this icy voice, Well, obviously you've been hit by a truck, and I was just wondering about the other casualties. After that, he got louder and not so funny, and it ends up I'm restricted for 3 days. Toby mugged an exaggeratedly exasperated look again and strolled off, leaving the girls absolutely devastated with giggles. It was all very well having a rule about not laughing at Toby, but it wasn't always easy to stick to it. That night at home, Melanie brought up the subject of playing outdoors and got her parents started on an argument about it. Her father's opinion was that we can't keep them cooped up forever. And fortunately, he won. On the condition that Marshall and Melanie promise not to play alone. So it all had to wait until the Rosses could get around to talking with Mrs. Hall and Mrs. Chung and get everything all decided. And by then, it was already Thursday. On Thursday afternoon, the three girls picked up Marshall at his nursery school and hurried to Egypt. They had just 1 day to spend there in peace and quiet before the coming of the outsiders. It was a nice sunny afternoon, and everything was right where they'd left it. But somehow it was hard to keep their minds on the game. They were all worrying about the next day. They were wondering if the boys really wanted to play, or if they just wanted to tease and make trouble. April said it wouldn't surprise her a bit if they showed up with half the boys in the 6th grade and just smashed everything to pieces. In fact, April said she thought they might just as well give the whole thing up and go away and never come back. Later, Elizabeth, with worried wrinkles in her forehead, asked Melanie if April really meant it. Were they really going to give up the Egypt game? But Melanie told her not to worry. She doesn't mean it, Melanie said. She's just in a bad mood about something. Can't you tell? And April was in a bad mood. She had been in a bad mood since the day before when she'd gotten a letter from Hollywood. The letter was from Dorothea, and it was very cheery and chatty, and it said that Dorothea and Nick had gotten married. Dorothea chatted about how happy she and Nick were, and how she'd moved into Nick's apartment, and there really wasn't much room. Of course, the letter said, we're both looking forward just awfully to the time when we can get more settled and have a bigger place and have you come to live with us. But in the meantime, darling, I'm sending the rest of your things on up to Caroline's, as the storage situation here is just terrible. There was a lot more about the big part that Dorothea was about to get. Not the same one as she'd written about last time, which hadn't really been her type of thing anyway. But this new part... April hadn't finished the letter. She had torn it up into little tiny pieces and flushed it down the toilet, so she couldn't change her mind and paste it back together. Then she sat on the windowsill and stared off up Orchard Avenue. She had still been sitting there when Caroline came in, but April hadn't turned around. "I got a letter from your mother today, too, dear," Caroline had said. She put one hand very gently on April's shoulder. Hot tears had drowned April's eyes, and painful gulps climbed up her throat. She had hated the hand on her shoulder, and she had hated Caroline because it was all her fault. She'd been all right until Caroline came in, just angry. Mad, 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 but all right. And then Caroline had to come in and make her cry. Caroline had just stood there, and once or twice she had made a little sound in her throat, as if she were going to say something. But she never did. After a while, the painful gulps wore themselves out, and the tears running down April's cheeks began to feel almost good, soothing like warm rain. Suddenly, she had felt empty and very tired, and because she was so tired, she let her head lean over towards Caroline, just a little bit, not really touching, but almost. They stayed that way for quite a while, and then Caroline had given April's shoulder a squeeze, kissed her quickly on top of the head, and gone out. April had sat there a while longer, tasting the tears on her face with the tip of her tongue, and thinking how long it had been since she'd cried enough to taste. And thinking, too, that a kiss on top of the head was okay, and didn't make you want to rub it off the way a kiss on the cheek did. Things were better after that, but April had gone on being in a bad mood. Melanie didn't know about the letter, but she knew something was wrong, and she was worried. Friday afternoon was going to be difficult enough without April's being in one of her touchy moods. But by Friday, April was in a much better frame of mind. Melanie could tell that she had gotten her mind off whatever it had been that was bothering her, because she started making cheerful plans in school about getting the best of Ken and Toby. That afternoon, the girls and Marshall got to the storage yard first, and they were all sitting on the edge of the temple floor, just waiting, when Ken and Toby arrived. Ken had to do a certain amount of squeezing and inhaling to get through the fence, but skinny Toby came through almost as easily as the girls, now that he wasn't wearing boxes. They didn't say much at first, just, "Hi." And then the boys started looking around at the altars and the things on them. The girls watched warily, trying to figure out just what they had in mind. After a few minutes, Melanie decided that Ken really didn't have anything in mind at all. He looked reluctant and puzzled, and a little bit embarrassed. She decided that Ken was only there because Toby was. So she started watching Toby. It was easy to tell by looking at Toby's dark eyes that something important was going on behind them. They almost gave you the feeling that you could hear things inside his head going whirr, clank, buzz. But for once, it didn't seem to have anything to do with laughter. Melanie began to get the feeling that maybe Toby wasn't just there to tease and cut up after all. So when Toby started asking questions about the things on the altars and about Set and Isis, Melanie started giving straight answers. At first, April poked her and frowned in a way that said not to give everything away. But after a while, she changed her mind and started answering questions too. She even took the secret scrolls out of their hiding place in the hollow base of the statue of Diana and showed the boys the list of things to do for different ceremonies and the partly finished hieroglyphic alphabet. Finally, Toby left the shed and walked to the middle of the yard. Ken looked relieved. "Well, I guess that's all there is to see," he said to Toby. "We might as well split, huh? We'll still have time to get in the game up at school." But Toby shook his head. "I don't feel like playing basketball," he said. "Besides, I sort of dig this Egyptian stuff. Let's hang around a while, okay?" Ken shrugged. "Sheesh," he said. "I don't care. But the whole scene's pretty kooky, if you ask me." It turned out that Toby wasn't kidding. He really did dig the Egypt game. He wanted to hear and see everything. And that first afternoon, he somehow managed to talk the girl Egyptians into doing all their ceremonies and rituals over for him to watch. At first, they were still a little suspicious and embarrassed, but when it became clear that he wasn't going to tease, they became more enthusiastic. A couple of times, he even made approving comments like, "Hey, weirdo," or toughness. Ken was pretty respectful about the whole thing, too. He kept hitting himself on the forehead and saying, "Sheesh!" But his tone of voice seemed to indicate amazement more than anything else. As they were all leaving, a little before 5:30, Toby asked the girls to write down the names of some of the best books about Egypt. He said he was going to the library that evening to check some out. That night, April and Melanie sat on Melanie's bed, and, feeling very pleased with things in general, they discussed the future. The first meeting of the enlarged Egypt gang had gone off much more smoothly than they had expected. They didn't admit it, even to each other, but they had both been flattered by Ken's and Toby's respectful interest. "And maybe, after a week or two, they'll lose interest," Melanie said. "Maybe they'll play for a while, and then they'll get homesick for their old ball games, and everything will be just like it used to be."
"Yeah," April agreed. "I'll bet they do. Or else, maybe they won't even come back at all. Maybe they were just curious, and now that they know all about it, they just might not bother to come back. And I don't think they're going to fink to the other kids, either. At least, not as long as they don't get mad at us or something. You know, I wouldn't be surprised if they just don't show up tomorrow at all."
Hieroglyphics. Ken and Toby showed up in Egypt the next day, all right. They showed up right on time, overflowing with ideas and loaded down with stuff. At least, Toby was overflowing with ideas, and Ken was carrying most of the stuff. The four original Egyptians were especially thrilled and amazed about the stuff the boys brought for Set. It seemed that sixth-grade boys just normally kept a lot of things around that were perfect for the altar of an evil god. Set's altar, which had always been rather bare in comparison to Isis's jeweled and flowered throne, was suddenly rich with ornaments. There were several lifelike rubber things, spiders, snakes, and bugs. There was a real skull of a medium-sized animal, maybe a cat or a skunk, and a well-preserved dead tarantula. There was a wicked-looking theatrical dagger with a twisted blade that sank into the handle to make fake stabbings look real. But the two best things were a shrunken head and a large stuffed owl. The shrunken head wasn't real, of course, but it was an expensive rubber one that did look terribly real. It was Ken's, and he was obviously quite pleased with himself for bringing it. The owl was Toby's, and it was real. That is, it had been once, but now it was stuffed. It was a little beat-up looking, but Toby said that was because he'd had it ever since he was a baby. Actually, what he said was that his father had given it to him to cut his teeth on when he was 5 months old, but that might only have been one of Toby's stories. Anyway, it looked great perched on a little shelf just above the altar of the evil god. It sat there, in the shadows among the spider webs, and peered down balefully over its tooth-scarred beak. At first, Toby suggested that it could be a servant of Set, whose duty was to carry the message of doom to Set's victims. But later on, someone remembered Thoth, the bird-headed god of wisdom and writing. From then on, the owl was known as Thoth. Besides all the other stuff, Toby had also brought some pencils and paper. He said he'd been thinking it over, and he'd decided the first thing they ought to do was finish the alphabet of hieroglyphics the girls had started.
"Oh, is that right?" April said. "Is that what you've decided? Whose Egypt game do you think this is, anyway? Just because..."
She had a lot more things to say, but Toby interrupted. Okay, okay. Cool it for a minute and let me finish. Let me tell you the rest of my idea before you start flipping your wig. Then, if you don't dig it, he shrugged, we won't do it. That seemed fair enough, so April shut up, but she kept her eyes narrowed warily as Toby explained. When they had the alphabet all made up, they could memorize it and use it to write secret messages at school and every place. They could write about things like when to meet in Egypt again, and what they thought of the teacher, and all sorts of other private information. Then, if the messages fell into enemy hands, no one would know what it was all about. Besides that, Toby thought they should each choose an Egyptian name. Marshall was already Marsha Moses, and a hieroglyphic symbol that stood for the name. That way, each one could sign his messages with his symbol, and that would make the whole thing more mysterious. Toby took out a piece of paper all folded up into a tiny square and spread it out on the floor of the shed. On it were some hieroglyphics and some Egyptian names that he had copied out of books the night before. Everyone except April immediately got down on hands and knees and began to examine the paper eagerly and discuss possible names. April was telling herself it was a crummy idea, when all of a sudden she remembered Bastet. Bastet had always seemed especially intriguing to April. She was a sort of cat goddess, and there was a famous statue of her as a cat, with cruel, mysterious eyes and earrings in her ears. If you were to pick the name of Bastet, your symbol could be a cat's head with earrings. Hey, she said, dropping down to join the group. I've got a great one. Everybody liked April's name and hieroglyph. In fact, Toby said it gave him an idea for a hieroglyph for himself. He'd already picked out his name. It was going to be Ramos, after a famous Egyptian wise man. And since an owl was supposed to be wise, what could be better than an owl's head for a symbol? Melanie knew right away what she wanted her name to be. She had gone once with her parents to hear Leontine Price sing Aida, and had been fascinated with the tragic story of the beautiful princess who had been a captive in ancient Egypt. As a matter of fact, she'd already thought of herself as Aida at times, when they were playing the Egypt game, but she hadn't told anyone. A symbol to go with Aida was a bit of a problem, but finally Melanie picked the bird hieroglyph because it stood for the letter A in the real Egyptian alphabet. When everyone was through choosing, Melanie made a new scroll and added it to the secret records. Ken had picked the name of Horemheb, because Toby said Horemheb had been a great general and also a pharaoh. He thought up his own hieroglyph of a bloody sword. There wasn't anything particularly Egyptian about it, but it did seem to go with being a general. Elizabeth's symbol was April's idea. It was a real Egyptian hieroglyph, and it meant heart, to go with Nefertiti, which means beloved one. And of course, Marshall's hieroglyph was the double crown of Egypt, because he was already the boy pharaoh, and that's what he liked to be best. The next few meetings of the Egyptians were taken up with finishing the hieroglyphic alphabet and memorizing it. Some of the letters that they used in their alphabet were actual Egyptian hieroglyphs, but for the sounds that were missing in the Egyptian alphabet, as well as a few that were too difficult to draw in their original form, they made up their own. Then, because their book on Egyptian writing told how hieroglyphics were considered magical works of art as well as writing, and because they were always done in many bright colors, it was decided that some sets of colored pens were necessary. So the game was suspended for a couple of afternoons while money was raised to buy the pens. Ken and Toby mowed a few lawns, and the girls and Marshall scouted the neighborhood for empty bottles to return to the grocery store. Just buying the pens took most of another afternoon, because it took so long to get waited on at Schmidt's variety store. Melanie said her mother said that the reason Mr. Schmidt never had a clerk for long was that he paid such low salaries. Except for Mr. Schmidt's cousin, a stocky red-headed young man with blotchy freckles, there was no one working in the store that day but Mr. Schmidt. The cousin never waited on customers, but only dusted shelves and brought stuff out from the back room. And Mr. Schmidt himself never waited on kids until after all the grown-ups were taken care of, no matter who'd been there longest. So the Egypt gang waited and waited, and it was all pretty frustrating. But the pens were worth the effort, and during the next few days, Egypt was full of scribes practicing the ancient art of hieroglyphic writing. In a short time, all sorts of possibilities were suggested and explored. Letters were written and exchanged and deciphered. Decorative hieroglyphic borders were added to the poster paint pictures that already adorned the walls of the temple. Secret mailing spots were picked out all around the neighborhood, such as a certain clump of weeds in an untended parkway, or the crotch of a particular plum tree. A mysterious and beautifully drawn page of hieroglyphics got loose in the sixth grade class at Wilson School and was passed around and puzzled over by everyone, including the teacher. But no one came even close to figuring it out. And of course, no one was as loudly and dramatically puzzled as the 4 sixth grade members of the Egypt game. Later, there was a brief and bloodless war, a sort of battle of the scribes, when Ramos and Bastet started an argument over whether a line of hieroglyphics should be written from left to right or from up to down. Everybody took sides and went home mad, and for a day or two, Toby and Ken went back to playing basketball after school. It turned out to be a good thing, really, because they were just in time to find out about a plot. Some of the other boys had gotten so curious about what Ken and Toby had found to do after school that was better than basketball, that they were getting ready to launch an investigation. Toby took care of that in a hurry. Without exactly saying so, he managed to spread the rumor that he and Ken had an after-school job, a very serious job involving actual work. Toby figured that there was nothing less interesting to most of the kids he knew than an after-school job. And he was right. After that, the other boys weren't nearly so curious. Then, when a few days had passed and all the Egyptians had had a chance to cool off, Ken and Toby turned up in Egypt again, and the others were glad to see them. It did seem best not to talk about hieroglyphics right away. But that was all right because everyone was a little tired of them anyhow, particularly Marshall. It wasn't that Marshall hadn't taken any interest in hieroglyphic writing, because he had. As a matter of fact, he could almost do a better job of reading and writing in Egyptian than he could in English. But, since he wasn't even in kindergarten yet, he wasn't exactly fluent in either one. So towards the end of the hieroglyphic period, when he'd learned about as much Egyptian writing as he felt ready for, he hadn't had very much to do. Most of the time he spent just watching. He had watched the other Egyptians writing and planning and arguing. He had watched an ant hole in the corner of the storage yard, and every once in a while he had watched the little window in one of the walls of the land of Egypt. Then, one day, not long after Ken and Toby returned to the land of Egypt, a neighbor's cat got into the Chung's apartment and killed Peter, the parakeet, the only pet Elizabeth had ever owned. Elizabeth was broken-hearted, and it was while they were trying to cheer her up that April and Melanie got the idea for the ceremony for the dead. The Ceremony for the Dead. It was Saturday afternoon, and April, Melanie, and Marshall had just come down to get Elizabeth to join the boys in Egypt for a previously scheduled rendezvous. When Elizabeth met them at the door with her dead pet and tears in her eyes, it was only natural that somebody should think of a funeral. And when April and Melanie started tossing the idea back and forth, decorating and elaborating the way they always did, it worked just the way it was supposed to. Elizabeth's tears slowed up, and a damp dimple flickered in her cheek. By the time the three girls and Marshall squeezed through the fence to Egypt, where Ken and Toby were already waiting, a great deal of the necessary background material was already beginning to take shape. Prince Pethotep, son of the great Queen Neferbeth, had just fallen in a battle with a terrible monster, and his body was being taken in solemn procession to the temple of Anubis, god of the dead. Ken and Toby were gratifyingly enthusiastic. In fact, Toby, who always had to be right in the middle of everything, insisted right away that he and Ken, Horemheb, that is, were going to be the high priests of Anubis. "Now, just a minute," April said. "Melanie and I thought up this ceremony. We get to be the high priestesses of the dead."
"You mean Aida. You and Aida," Toby corrected.
Just the day before, a rule had been passed that members should be called only by their Egyptian names while they were inside the land of Egypt.
"Okay, me and Aida. Anyway, it was our idea."
"Yeah, but I've just finished reading a great book that tells all about what they did to the mummies and everything. I've got some tough ideas."
"So have I," April said.
"Queen Neferbeth ought to choose the high priest," Melanie said, interrupting the exchange of glares. "After all, it's her parakeet." That broke the deadlock. Elizabeth didn't want to decide against anybody, so she put a pebble in one hand and let them choose. Ken and Toby won and got to be the high priests of Anubis. The first thing Toby did as high priest was to announce that the whole thing was going to take a long time. "In real Egyptian times," he said, "the preparation of the dead and the funeral ceremony took as much as 40 days. Theirs wouldn't take that long, but maybe it would last as much as 5 or 6. He said that before he could really get started, they were going to need a lot of supplies. So until he could get the things he needed, they might just as well go on with the procession to the temple. Melanie suggested that the procession needed palm branches and flower petals and that sort of thing. And of course, everyone thought of the trash bin behind the florist shop. So, a few minutes later, the entire population of Egypt was sneaking up the alley on the way to sort over the florist's recent rejects. As soon as they returned, loaded with loot, the procession got underway. Marshall came first, carrying the smoking incense burner. Next came Elizabeth, as the queen mother and chief mourner. One of the curtain robes was draped over her head as a veil, and she carried a big bouquet of only slightly wilted dahlias. Then came April and Melanie as the mourning populace, scattering flowers and chanting, "Weep for Prince Pethotep, fallen in battle," in a high, mournful wail. And last of all came the two high priests of Anubis, carrying on a flower-strewn plank the dead body of Prince Pethotep. The procession wound its way back and forth across the storage yard several times and came to a stop in the temple. There the bier was placed on a specially prepared altar in the middle of the floor. At that point, the ceremony had to stop for fresh ideas. Since this was the first ceremony for the dead, there was no record scroll to follow, and it was necessary to stop now and then for discussion and new suggestions. Afterwards, of course, Melanie would make a record of the things that were done, and any future ceremony for the dead wouldn't have to stop and start. All the other ceremonies and rites had been developed in the same way, but this time there was a difference. This was the first new ceremony to be made up since the coming of the two new Egyptians, and the first real ceremony they'd actually taken part in. April and Melanie had often wondered if they ever really would. But they needn't have wondered. The boys took part, all right, and to an extent that nobody had expected. For instance, it was Toby who suggested that they march around the altar, beating their chests and sprinkling their heads with ashes and wailing. That wasn't so much of a surprise. He'd already demonstrated that he had lots of good ideas. It was the way he threw himself into the part that came as a shock to the girls. He was so different from what he was at school. At school, he was Toby the cool cat, sophisticate. And now, suddenly, he was Toby, the grief-stricken ancient Egyptian. And somehow, he gave the feeling there were a lot of other roles he could play just as well. Ken was a different matter, although he, too, did a lot better than anybody would have expected. He was, of course, absolutely perfect at being himself, and he was very much at home in the role. But this Egyptian business was something else again. And so, while Toby staggered around the altar, beating his chest with wild-eyed abandon, sprinkling real ashes, left over from Set's sacrificial fire, in his hair, and wailing like a wounded electric guitar, and while, right behind him, April and Melanie did more or less the same things, just about as realistically, except they were using imaginary ashes, because to a girl even the death of a pharaoh isn't worth a dirty head. And while Elizabeth did everything April and Melanie did only softer, and while even Marshall marched with solemn assurance, thumping his chest firmly with a hand that wasn't holding security, and making a noise like a stuck record player, Ken brought up the rear. If the rest of them could do it, Ken Kamata could, too. And he did. But it wasn't easy. Every time he thumped his chest or made a brief, half-hearted wail, he felt his ears get hot, and from time to time he announced to nobody in particular, "Sheesh! I feel like a nut." When 5:30 came and everyone was leaving, Toby told the other members of the Egypt game to call him up that evening, and he would assign them something to bring. He was going to do some research, he said, to find out exactly what was needed to make a mummy. But there was an awful lot to learn about mummies, and even after a whole evening of study, it turned out that Toby's information wasn't all that complete. For instance, when Ken, who was assigned to bring oil, wanted to know what kind, Toby couldn't exactly say. It didn't seem likely that the ancient Egyptians used any of the kinds Ken and Toby knew about. Crankcase, sewing machine, polyunsaturated, or bicycle. They finally settled for bicycle, because oil was oil, and bicycle was the only kind that Ken owned personally. When the Egyptians had assembled the next afternoon, bringing their offerings of oil and spice and salt and perfume, Toby, Ramos, gave a little talk on how to prepare a mummy. It was a good speech, but it suffered from frequent interruptions, because Bastet and Aida had read the same book and had some ideas of their own. And there was another pause while everyone tried to comfort Queen Neferbeth, who got all upset when Ramos spoke indelicately about taking out the guts. It turned out that Queen Neferbeth felt so strongly about cutting holes in Petey, even if he were dead, that it was decided to dispense with that part of the procedure. "It'll be all right, Ramos," Horemheb said. "He's so little he can't have enough guts to make that much difference." Toby was disappointed, but he had to admit that according to the book, there was another way. Poor people, who couldn't afford the more expensive process, had been simply soaked in brine.
So, the rest of the afternoon was taken up in preparing a saltwater bath for Prince Pitotep, and placing him in it with the proper pomp. Then he was left to soak. The appearance of the mummy-to-be when he was removed from his brine bath on the following afternoon was something of a shock to everybody. His wet feathers stuck to his tiny body, and he was covered with a thick, white, salty scum. When Toby lifted him gingerly out of the brine by one claw, everybody felt a little queasy, and Elizabeth's eyes became suspiciously liquid. Toby glanced at her and sighed impatiently. "Now, just cool it a minute, Neferbeth," he said. "I'll have him all fixed up in 2 seconds." He hastily poured some fresh water over the parakeet and dried him off on the tail of his T-shirt, which was huge and dingy and probably belonged to his father. When Pitotep was dry and his feathers rearranged, he did look almost as good as new, and the mummification process continued. In the next few days, he was anointed with spices and perfume, wrapped in thin strips of oil-soaked cloth, and laid to rest with a supply of birdseed and a few of his favorite toys, in a smallish pyramid made of old bricks. It was a good week in the land of Egypt. Melanie collected several new ceremonies to add to the sacred records. Ken began to find being an ancient Egyptian a little less embarrassing, and Elizabeth felt so proud of the important part that Petey had played, she almost forgot how much she missed him. But as the Egypt game became second nature to its 6 participants, and they began to feel more and more at home in the land of Egypt, they gradually began to forget about being cautious. Ceremonies, discussions, and arguments began to be carried on in normal or even louder than normal tones, and no one stopped to worry about being overheard. Only one very small Egyptian had an idea that the land of Egypt was being watched, and for some reason that was his own and private, he didn't choose to tell. The Oracle of Thoth. Strange as it may seem, Mrs. Granger, the 6th grade teacher at Wilson, was responsible for the next phase of the Egypt game. It all grew out of the fact that an assignment the class was reading just barely mentioned something called an oracle. Toby had a pretty good idea of what an oracle was, but he decided to ask Mrs. Granger about it, in the hopes of getting her started on one of her long-winded explanations. A test was scheduled for the end of the period, and Mrs. Granger had been known to forget about such things, if you handled it just right. So Toby asked a question about oracles, and sure enough, it worked. He'd picked on a subject that Mrs. Granger could really get her teeth into. She got that gleam in her eye and started out full blast, and Toby settled back, feeling sure she was good for the rest of the time until recess. But the way it turned out, the whole thing sort of backfired, because by the end of the period, the whole class, Toby included, was as hung up on the whole oracle bit as Mrs. Granger was. As a matter of fact, it had completely slipped Toby's mind that he'd only asked about it to head off a test. Mrs. Granger could do that sort of thing to you if you weren't careful. During library period, which came next, a lot of people got stuff to read about oracles, and that afternoon there was another discussion in class. Everyone had come up with a lot of dope about the different kinds of oracles and how they predicted the future in different ways, through the actions of sacred snakes or birds or fish, or even through the way the insides of a dead animal were arranged when the priests cut it open. There is even one very famous one that was run by a priestess who went into a kind of trance or fit, and while she was clear off in this trance, she spouted out a lot of messages and stuff that were supposed to come right straight from the mouths of the gods. The oracles all had special sacred places, caves or grottos, or specially built temples, and there were all sorts of far-out things connected with them, like sacred fires and mystic vapors and magical statues. Among the stuff reported to the class was a list of the countries that had depended on oracles to help the rulers decide how to run things. And one of the countries was Egypt. As soon as he heard it, Toby remembered reading something about the Egyptian priests making predictions, but he just hadn't been thinking about the oracles in connection with the Egypt game until that moment. He snuck a glance in the direction of Ross in February to see if they had the same idea, and sure enough, they had. It was easy to tell. They were staring at each other in that way they had. If they were where they could talk, Toby thought to himself, one of them would be starting a sentence and the other finishing it, as if they had Siamese brains or something. Just at that moment, the girl stopped staring at each other and turned and stared at Toby. They were giving him that bit with the eyes they used on each other, and if he wanted to, Toby could have given it right back. He knew what they were saying, all right. Instead, he slowly and deliberately made his eyes go crossed and let his mouth fall open in a stupid idiot face. The reaction was just what he'd expected. The girls looked shocked, then angry, and then they turned their backs and worked hard at ignoring him for the rest of the period. Toby let his mind go back to his plans for the afternoon, with a feeling of satisfaction. They would have forgotten about being mad by the time school was out, and besides, they'd really asked for it. He'd told those dames before. Egypt was Egypt, but at school, you had to play it cool. That afternoon's 2 hours in Egypt turned out to be mostly a long discussion of the what and how of the Egyptian oracle. April had her mind set on the kind of oracle that got its messages from the gods through a high priestess with fits. And, naturally, she was all set to be the high priestess. She would sit on a throne before the sacred fire, surrounded by swirling mystic vapors, and people who wanted predictions would write their question on a slip of paper and drop it in the fire. She would go into a trance, and then she would speak with the voice of the gods. That was just great as far as the trance was concerned, Toby thought. If anybody could throw a far-out fit, April could. And if he hadn't cooked up such a great idea himself, he'd have been tempted to go along with April's version, just to see how she'd do it. But the fact of the matter was, he had a scheme that was going to make the oracle bit just about the greatest thing that had ever hit the land of Egypt. So, much as he hated to do it, he set about spoiling April's plans. "So, when they dropped their questions in the fire," he asked, "how are you going to know what to answer? Particularly if you haven't even seen the question." "You must not have been listening in class today," April said. "I don't have to know. The gods speak through the mouth of the priestess." Sometimes it was hard to tell whether April was kidding or whether she really believed stuff like that. Ken was looking at April in consternation. "You really think the gods are..." His voice faded away, and for a minute he just stared at April. "Sheesh," he said at last. "You really are cracking up this time." But Toby only raised an eyebrow and gave April his cool amusement look. "Sure," he said, "but don't you think we ought to have something else planned? Just in case the gods don't get the message." Then, while April glared at him, Toby told everybody his idea, and naturally everybody thought it was the greatest. Even April, after she'd had a chance to cool off. The way Toby saw it,
somebody would think up a question they wanted answered about the future. Then they would write it on a piece of paper and bring the paper to the temple of the oracle. At the temple, the priest, or priestess, he added graciously, would pass the paper over the sacred fire and do whatever other stuff he could think up. Then, and this was the good part, he would take it to this special altar they would build for Thoth and put the question in his beak and leave it there overnight. Toby jumped up and grabbed Thoth down off the shelf and dusted him off. After all, Toby said, Thoth was the Egyptian god of wisdom, and this crazy priestess bit was something the Greeks thought up. That was a good point, and after that there wasn't much more argument, except that April did say, if they were going to be so particular, how about the fact that actually Thoth was supposed to be an ibis, and not an old chewed-up owl? But nobody paid much attention to her. They were all too busy starting in on Thoth's altar and planning the ceremony for consulting the oracle. It was decided that they would draw straws, and the winner would get to be the first one to ask the oracle a question. They gave the straws to Marshall to hold, and everybody drew. And, just as you'd think, the winner was Ken, the one guy who really didn't want to win.
"Sheesh," Ken said. "I don't know anything to ask. Anything I can't find out for myself, I don't even want to know."